In his new book, Command and Control Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, investigative journalist Eric Schlosser explores the dilemma that has existed since the dawn of the nuclear age. How do you deploy weapons of mass destruction without being destroyed by them? As he makes clear in this researched and eye-opening exploration of America's nuclear weapons, the most important of questions has never been resolved. Again, the title of the book is Command and Control, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Eric Schlosser to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
What got you thinking about nuclear weapons and this particular topic in such detail?
My book, Fast Food Nation, was set in Colorado Springs. And after I finished that book, I spent a lot of time with the Air Force there. There are some major Air Force bases in Colorado Springs, and particularly bases devoted to the future of warfare in space. We've got the Air Force Space Command, the United States Space Command used to be headquartered there. And I was interested in writing about that. And as I was spending time with Air Force officers there, I began to hear more and more stories about nuclear weapons. Many of the people in the Air Force Space Command began their careers in underground launch complexes for intercontinental ballistic missiles. So I became less interested in the future of laser beam weapons and directed energy beam weapons, and more interested in these Cold War stories of nuclear weapons they were telling me. And one story in particular stuck in my mind. It was the story of this nuclear weapons accident in Damascus, Arkansas, in September 1980. And an officer told me that story, and I just said, I've got to find out more about it. And it took years, and the result is this book.
I want to talk about that accident in just a moment, but part of the subtitle is The Illusion of Safety. Do you think we live in that illusion now, that since the Cold War has passed, that the direct threat of nuclear weapons upon us is not that great?
I think that's the widespread view. There's a remarkable amount of historical amnesia about nuclear weapons. The ending of the Cold War, the way it ended, was so miraculous. I mean, I'm 54. When I was growing up, if you had said that the Berlin Wall would come down and Germany would be reunited and the Soviet Union would vanish from the face of the earth without a nuclear war, without a major war in Europe that would kill tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, people would have thought you were crazy. It would have been inconceivable when I was a kid for that to happen. But it happened. And I think there was such joy and such relief that the Cold War ended without a nuclear exchange. People just forgot there are thousands of these weapons still out there, ready to be used at a moment's notice. And the problem sort of has been swept under the rug. There's an entire generation that's grown up knowing almost nothing about nuclear weapons. So the danger never went away, but the awareness of the danger definitely has.
How did danger come to a place like Damascus, Arkansas?
Well, Damascus, Arkansas is a small town in the foothills of the Ozarks, and mainly rural, lots of little farms, beautiful countryside. And one of the unusual things about it was that it had a Titan II missile silo right outside of town. The Titan II was the largest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States ever built. It was over 100 feet tall, so think of a 10-story building, you know, round, made of steel. And on top of that missile was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever put on a missile. That one warhead on the Titan II in the silo in Damascus, Arkansas, had more explosive force than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, and that includes both atomic bombs, actually three times the explosive force of all those armaments combined. So it was an extraordinarily powerful weapon on top of our most powerful ballistic missile waiting to be launched.
What brought that particular silo to Arkansas in the first place? Why strategically was that a good placement?
It was a good placement because the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee in the late 1950s, Wilbur Mills, who was a very powerful Democrat, thought that it would be good economically for his state to have some defense spending. Now, being located towards the center of the country is a good thing, because the further away from the coast, the more difficult to be attacked by the Soviet Union. But at the same time, the ideal place for intercontinental ballistic missiles would be in much more wide-open areas like the Great Plains and the Dakotas, which are very sparsely inhabited. In Arkansas, you had missile silos in and around little towns with farms, you know, a quarter of a mile, half mile, a mile away from them. And it was a very odd place to put an intercontinental ballistic missile, and the decision was much more political than strategic in origin.
And with those, with that politics, at what point, and you write about this in the book, but the monitoring of that site, what went into that as far as the day-to-day? I mean, it's sort of there, right?
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the Titan II, and what makes it very different from the Minuteman III missiles that we have today, is that the Titan II crew lived literally down the hall from the missile. So you had a four-man crew in an underground complex. On the third floor of their underground complex, they had cots and a kitchen and a little sitting area. On the second floor of their complex where all the controls were for the missile, and then underground was a lot of the machinery that kept the complex operating. But there was a long cableway and big, big blast doors at the end of the cableway to protect the crew. But down that long steel hallway underground was this gigantic missile. And so it was very unusual for the crew, because even though they were separated by these big, thick, massive steel blast doors, they were aware that just down the hall was the most powerful warhead we'd ever put on a missile, and this enormous missile in a silo. The Minuteman crews today in their launch control centers are miles and miles away from the silo and from the missiles. So they could go weeks, months, you know, without ever seeing a missile, whereas the missile was part of the day-in, day-out consciousness of these Titan II crews in Arkansas, in Arizona, and in Kansas, where the silos were located.
And this is 1970s.
The accident occurred in September of 1980. The missile itself was the product of late 1950s, early 1960s technology. These missiles went online, went on alert in around 1963, and that was one of the problems by the time 1980 came along and when the accident occurred. This was essentially an obsolete weapon system that the Kennedy administration had talked about retiring. While Kennedy was president, they were thinking about taking these missiles out of the silos by 1967, 1968. But as the Cold War intensified and as the Soviet Union built more and more of its own missiles, it was difficult for the Air Force and the Pentagon to justify taking these powerful missiles off alert without getting something in return from the Soviets in armed control talks. And the Soviets realized these things were obsolete and didn't want to trade any of their new weapons for them. So in the book is a narrative in a minute-by-minute sense of how this accident unfolded and how close we came to a detonation in Arkansas. But I go off on tangents to describe some of the thinking of the time. And the thinking of the time and the politics of the time led an obsolete missile, which in many ways was unsafe, to remain on duty in the middle of a very inhabited area. And in many ways, it was an accident waiting to happen.
You make the point that, you know, an accident waiting to happen and how close we came, but the quick answer to that is we came really damn close. And I'm curious as to when in looking back at the story, this is something that is old and should have been retired long ago. What were the immediate ingredients that brought this to a pinnacle in 1980?
Well, the story of the accident itself, what
yes.
happened?
Yes.
Well, they were doing routine maintenance on this Titan II in Damascus, Arkansas. It was the kind of thing the repairmen did all the time. And there were a couple of guys working on a steel platform near the top of the missile. And they were about to unscrew a pressure cap, again, completely routine, no big deal, when the socket fell off of the wrench handle. And the socket dropped. It bounced off the steel work platform. And one of the workers reached for it, missed, and the socket fell through a very narrow gap in between the platform and the top of the missile. The socket dropped about 70 feet or so, bounced off the silo wall, ricocheted, hit the missile, pierced a hole in the skin of the missile, and suddenly thousands of gallons of extremely toxic, flammable, explosive rocket fuel were filling the silo. And the Air Force had kept the Titan II on alert for 17 years, but nothing like this had ever happened before. And they just didn't know what to do. So that's really where the book begins. And then the book tells the story of how the Air Force and some very brave young airmen tried to save the missile, prevent an explosion, and prevent the detonation of the most powerful warhead we ever put on a missile. And the book is about nuclear weapons, but it's much less about the famous physicists like Oppenheimer and Teller, and it's much less about, you know, the presidential advisors, although they make appearances. The heart of the book is about the ordinary servicemen who served during the Cold War and who risked their lives, sometimes lost their lives, to prevent a nuclear war with the Soviet Union and to prevent nuclear catastrophes like the one that almost happened in Damascus. And, you know, to me, these stories really haven't been told, and we have not honored our Cold War veterans in the way that we have honored, you know, the World War II veterans and even now our Vietnam veterans. So there are many stories of individuals, you know, 19, 20, 22, 23 years old. It's remarkable how young the servicemen handling our nuclear weapons were and continue to be, and the bravery that they showed to prevent disasters.
Ultimately, they are the people who are preventing the disasters, but the information they have is really, it's quite limited, isn't it, as to what they're dealing with?
Yeah. The other narrative thread of the book is the engineers who were working as hard as they could to make sure that nuclear weapons wouldn't detonate accidentally, couldn't be stolen, couldn't be used by someone in the military without proper authorization. And one of the problems in the Cold War was there was incredible compartmentalized secrecy. So the guys who were handling the weapons in the field, the young airmen, the young repairmen, they literally did not know what some of the safety problems were with the weapons because they were not told. Meanwhile, at the weapons laboratories, the engineers who were designing these weapons and becoming more and more concerned that they had serious safety problems, didn't know how the weapons were being handled in the field. And, you know, I got one document through the Freedom of Information Act that was about 240 pages that was just a list of significant accidents and incidents involving nuclear weapons. I think it involved, I don't know that they were all in this one document, but it was just 240 pages of dropped bombs, short circuits, you know, submersions of weapons, all kinds of damage. And I showed this document to some of the weapons designers that I'd gotten to know, and they'd never seen it and were shocked by it. And what it meant was that the Air Force and the Navy weren't telling the people who were designing our weapons about all the accidents and incidents involving them. And when I interviewed, you know, bomber crews and missile crews, they had no idea that the weapons that they had been handling were at risk of accidental detonation. They might not have sat on them as casually or used them as tables for their lunch as they did. They just were so used to climbing around these weapons, they never thought that if one of them dropped accidentally, it could detonate.
We're speaking with Eric Schlosser, author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. What do you feel, as you write about, were the ultimate lessons that we learned and didn't learn from Damascus?
Well, there eventually was a move to install modern safety mechanisms in our nuclear weapons. I mean, you'd think that would be a no-brainer, but it was a huge bureaucratic battle to put safety mechanisms in our weapons. And in the book, I discuss, you know, why some of the armed services resisted it. They thought they would make the weapons less reliable. So one of the lessons that was learned is that we need modern safety mechanisms in our weapons, that warhead in Damascus would never be allowed today to be put on any missile because of the absence of certain safety mechanisms that it had. In a bigger sense, one of the lessons I took from that accident and how it unfolded is the huge, huge challenge of managing complex technological systems. We're very good at building them, and then when something goes wrong, we're not as good at figuring out what to do. And that was true at Damascus. It was true at Fukushima. It was true at Chernobyl. And, you know, any machine that's built is going to be flawed because it's built by human beings who are inherently imperfect. And when you have a toaster oven go wrong, that's a hassle. When your car breaks down because there's something wrong in the way it was built, that's a problem. But when you have a nuclear weapon go wrong, that's just orders of magnitude worse and can have profoundly catastrophic effects.
So to ask the obvious question of could this happen again, could this happen today, and it seems like the answer is of course.
The nuclear weapons the United States has today are vastly safer than the ones that we had in 1980, thanks to the work of some of the engineers that I write about in my book. They really achieved much, much safer nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, the weapon systems that those weapons are attached to, our Minuteman III missiles, our B-52 bombers, are aging. And some of the same problems that I write about that the United States was experiencing in its military in the 1970s, we're going to see again. I mean, the Minuteman III missile, which is our principal land-based missile, was first put into the ground around 1970-71. And the underground launch complexes for some of those Minuteman missiles were built in the early 1960s. So they're 50 years old. We have not built a B-52 bomber since the Kennedy administration, which is extraordinary, and that's our principal nuclear bomber. And then there's also one other thing to consider, in addition to the aging of our weapon systems, the testing equipment, the underground infrastructure. Whenever you have human beings involved in this system, you have great potential for error. So no, the danger did not go away. I mean, just in the last few weeks, we had the number two officer in the United States Strategic Command, responsible for, you know, all of our nuclear weapons, being relieved of duty, allegedly, for illegal gambling problem. We had the chief officer in our Air Force land-based missile system relieved of duty. The reasons have not been shown, have not been published, but the Associated Press suggested it was serious alcohol problem. And this is extraordinary. 6 or 7 years ago, the Air Force lost control of half a dozen thermonuclear weapons for a day and a half. They literally lost them, misplaced them. So this danger never went away. And it's different in nature from what it was 30 years ago. But these nuclear weapons are the most dangerous machines ever built. And we have to be extraordinarily vigilant about them. And their management is of the utmost importance. To me, it's the single most important thing that our military does, is safely manage nuclear weapons. And we've had some real problems in the last few years.
And the point you make at the very beginning of the book is that the story you're telling is an American story, but obviously the story is replicated elsewhere in the world, and we don't know those stories.
My book is extremely critical of the Pentagon. It's extremely critical of the Air Force. And at the same time, it's full of praise for the personal heroism of those who served. And I have no doubt the United States builds the safest, most technologically advanced nuclear weapons in the world. We invented this technology. We perfected it. I have more faith in our system than any other system. And that should give us pause. Because if you look at how close we came on so many occasions, and we invented the thing, think about India, think about Pakistan, think about Russia and the terrible industrial accidents they have. At the end of the book, I look at the rate of industrial accidents in other nuclear powers, as a rough measure of their ability to manage complex technological systems, and it's not reassuring. So hopefully I've written the book in a way that's open to different interpretations by different people. I've tried to be factual, write it calmly. It's not a diatribe. It's not a screed. And you can come away with your own opinion about what should be done about nuclear weapons. My opinion, having spent 6 years on this subject, the fewer of these things, the better. And the fewer countries that have them, the better. Because the more these machines, the more these really lethal machines spread throughout the world, and the more countries have them, the more likely you are to have a disaster, a catastrophe, either deliberate or accidental.
Eric Schlosser is the author of the new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. The book is published by the Penguin Press. Eric, it's always a great pleasure to have you join us. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Command and Control, by Eric Schlosser, published by the Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.